Good afternoon. So, last time, we went over stack smashing. This idea that we could take advantage of pretty much any buffer overflow of a buffer on the stack by overwriting a return address, which would be further up on the stack and at a higher address than that buffer, make that return address point to something we placed in the buffer, and then when that return address was used by a function returning, purportedly normally, it would actually return to the code in our buffer. And, if we made that what is often called shellcode, code that does what we want, where the canonical thing is running a shell, hence the name shellcode, then that would end up giving complete control to the attacker. We talked about some of the mechanics behind doing this. So one tricky thing is that we needed to make a pointer to the buffer on the stack. So we needed to figure out where the stack locations were. And we also need to figure out where exactly the return address to overwrite was. So we learned for figuring out where the return address to overwrite was, we could generally look at how the machine code or assembly set up the buffer on the stack and just compute that distance directly. For figuring out the stack location, we learned that, well, you could compute it by knowing where the stack starts, which for now we're kind of working under the assumption we don't randomize that. We'll get into today a little about how we might deal with that not being consistent. But once we know where it starts, we know how much is allocated by the time that function is called, and we can compute the location in the middle of the buffer. We also learned that, well, you didn't need to actually be that precise, that we could have what's commonly called a nop sled, just a bunch of nop instructions. And the idea is that if we do that before our shell code, then our pointer can point to anywhere in the middle of this bunch of nop instructions and it will work. So we just need to get approximately the location on the stack where the buffer is, not the exact location. Then we looked into issues of dealing with restricted characters. That sort of natural thing people might think when they're looking at some of the examples I showed is that, well, if we're not inputting binary data, which sometimes we're going to have to do that, but often we're like inputting text, we shouldn't be accepting all these funny characters that make up the pointer to the shellcode and the actual shellcode itself, because that's machine code. Machine code we usually think of as like looks like complete junk as text. We learned that, well, for the machine code, we actually have a lot of flexibility in what instructions we use, and if we're careful, we can usually avoid anything that might be filtered out of our input. And for pointers, well, that is more of a problem, but sometimes we can find something which we can control that's at an address who doesn't contain any funny characters. And I believe that's roughly where we left off last time. So questions about these topics from last time? Okay, so let's do a little diversion. So in all the examples of buffer overflows I showed so far, it looked like the big problem was that there was no bounds checking. And this is something we'll revisit again in the future, but it seems natural that, the issue is that we didn't even think of telling whatever thing was handling the input how much space it had and having it check. And you say, okay, so that means that if we check sizes, we're fine. And mostly yes, but code has bugs. And there's one very common pattern that sort of leads to a lot of buffer overflows despite people trying to check sizes. And this is integer overflow and underflow. So for example here, I get a length of my buffer and I say, okay, I'm going to compute how much to malloc for it. And I'm going to check whether that's too big, and then I'm going to malloc that amount of space and try to use this buffer. And question might be, well, is this going to stay within this buffer of items? We'll get into later, like, wait a moment, this is not on, this is a buffer on the heap. Is that actually useful to overflow? The answer is going to be yes. We'll talk about how later. But we have a buffer on the heap here that's total size bytes. We make sure that's not too big, and everything seems fine. It seems like there's no way that this function can, you know, read into something that's outside of that buffer, especially because we, like, just computed its size and allocated it. But we have a problem that there could be an overflow. That, let's say our length is this number here. We're doing computations with ints. Let's say these are 32 bits. So, and let's say our size is this number. This is 16 bytes. So I do that multiplication. Here's my total size. But that doesn't fit in an int. So here's our int. Our total size is 16 bytes. That's not going to be greater than our limit. So we're going to allocate 16 bytes and then proceed to write way more than 16 bytes. And this bug occurs a lot. It's a very easy thing to miss. It's a very easy thing not to test for, because why would you supply numbers that are, you know, way larger than the limit like this and expect that to be different than just a little larger than the limit? And it comes up all the time. And probably even more problematically about this is that signed overflow is undefined behavior in C, meaning that compilers sometimes, you know, do different things depending on how things are compiled for this. So questions on this overflow example? So your question is, shouldn't total size be a negative number, though, so it can't be greater than limit? When I do this multiplication here, I overflow so much, I don't set the sign bit. The sign bit overflows to 0 and not 1. So it's true if the size was smaller or the length was smaller, we'd end up with a negative number, which also wouldn't be greater than limit. But that wouldn't be useful to pass to malloc. So a key part of, like, why this works and why it's tricky to, you know, detect if you aren't looking for it is that, you know, commonly you'll end up with, like, a negative number, and that won't trigger the bad part of the bug, that the attacker is going to realize, wait a moment, I can carefully choose this length here. So the question is, why wouldn't it malloc 10 bytes? So it would allocate 16 bytes, and then this loop here is still based on the length. So we're going to access at items 1, which is going to be 0x10 bytes after the beginning of what's mallocked, which is out of bounds. And as we'll learn today, it's not unlikely that there's something that, like a return address, would be useful to overwrite in that memory. Does that explain what's going on here? So we do allocate only 10 bytes, but the issue here is that we kind of have this disagreement. And this occurs in real code. So for example, copy this slide from some later. So Google Chrome had some competitions to find bugs that could exploit the browser from a web page. And in one successful one, this person used a lot of exploits, going by the name Pinkie Pie, and he took advantage of an underflow here. That what happened here is they did this computation to compute a size, and they didn't think that, wait a moment, this could be less than the size of a UNT32. And thus end up computing a size that's too big, doesn't agree with the actual size. Especially because these are all unsigned numbers. Okay, so that's on integer overflow and underflow. So let's talk next about avoiding, we'll just start with stack smashing. We'll talk over several weeks. We'll go through a couple rounds of things that can avoid exploits and ways of working around them or not. So we're going to talk about a bunch of these, what we'll call mitigations. And these generally end up turning the vulnerability into something less bad. So for example, our goal today with the first mitigation we'll look at is to turn stack smashing into a crash. So we're going to look at how that goes, and we're going to evaluate all the mitigations we're going to look at this semester sort of in various different metrics. So one thing is like, does it work? Does it actually prevent the attack? And we'll find for many mitigations, the answer is going to be sometimes. Yes, it prevents the original attack, but there might be some variation which still works. Another question is going to be performance. All these mitigations we're doing are likely to affect performance somehow, because that's probably the reason why that wasn't the way things were originally done. Another concern is going to be, how generic is it? So some of these mitigations are going to require cooperation from the programmer. Some of them are going to require recompiles, and some aren't. If we could give us protection from stack overflows without recompiling anything, that would be great. We're going to find out that, what I'm going to talk about today, not quite there. So we're going to look specifically at stopping stack smashing. And we could think of a bunch of different places where we might want to take action that would succeed in stopping it. And we're going to actually look at all of these in the next couple lectures. So one thing we can look at is stopping the overrun. So that's just doing bounds checking. And mention that, that's sort of the canonical fix, that we just want the code to actually check the bounds of the buffer. But the way we know so far of doing that basically involves making the compiler always check that, which seems slow, and or it might not have enough information, or writing code to do that, which requires you write the correct code. So we're going to look at the second idea here, which is stopping the return to the attacker code, where the idea is that we want to not return if it's been overwritten. And so what we're going to use for this is something called a stack canary, that we're going to place in between the buffers and anything else that might be overwritten and the return address a dummy value here that we're going to check before we actually return from the function. And this is something that on our VM systems, for example, is enabled by default by the compiler. So the compiler will generate code like this. So it allocates something on the stack, and then it copies from this location here in thread local storage a value onto the stack, and then before the function returns, it reads that value again and compares it by XORing and seeing if the result is zero. And if the result is non-zero, it calls this stack check fail function, and this crashes the program. And if only if that doesn't happen, it returns. So the idea is that there's no way of reaching this return without doing this check first. So we can't return to anything anywhere if this stack canary has been replaced by a value that wasn't whatever this value that was retrieved was. So one question is, what's the size of this canary? So this is a 64-bit register. So it's a 8-byte value, which I assume they chose just because that's the most convenient size to copy around in 64-bit x86. Other questions about what's going on here? So there's a question in my example of, you know, is there enough room on the stack? Like, what's the stack layout for this function look like? So this function is allocating 0x20, which is 32 bytes on the stack. And we are placing at 0x18, which is 24 bytes after the beginning of that, the stack canary. So the canary, in fact, sits right at the top of that allocated space. And if this function has a buffer, it's probably not a very large one, because I took it from a simpler example. And so the operation here is that our hope is that if the attacker does a buffer overrun, they'll have replaced this canary with something, and hopefully the wrong value. So that check will fail, and even though this return address points there, the function will actually end up just calling that crash routine. So to make this work, we kind of rely on two properties, and we're going to look at both of these properties in a bit. But I want you to keep this in mind, because both of these are assumptions that we're making by choosing this stack canary strategy. If either of these aren't true, then it doesn't work anymore. So one assumption is that overwriting the return address means we must have overwritten the canary. And for the buffer overflows we've seen so far, that's the case, right? There's no way of going past the end of this buffer and keeping writing things and getting to the return address without getting to the canary first. But if that's somehow not true, we're going to be in trouble. This technique's not going to help us. Another assumption is that the canary is secret. For example, if in this code, instead of being this thread local storage value, if it was like 15, well, the attacker would just make sure that they put 15 here in the stuff they overwrote the buffer with. So it needs to be kept secret somehow. And typically what that's going to mean is that you generate a new one every time you run the program. And to give a concrete example of what's done for that, I looked up what the GNU C library does to generate that value. So it generates a random value, but it fixes some of the bytes. So it makes sure it's contains a zero, a new line, and an all ones byte. So the purpose of this stuff is to make it hard to input into a buffer, and the rest is basically going to be random. And so the purpose of the rest is to make it so that if you observe what the canary is once, you're not likely to guess it what it is anywhere else. But they can also take advantage of this to make it so that if you do find an overflow and figure out what the canary is, you have to have a buffer overflow that will let you put all these funny bytes in there that might not be something you'd always be able to find. So this is implemented ubiquitously, and it obviously requires compiler support. The compiler had to generate that assembly. Also, as you can see here, it required C library support in this case because something had to fill in this space here with the canary value. And, you know, this was proposed surprisingly not that long ago. I guess it seems like that long ago to you. So in 1998, well after buffer overflows had been a problem for quite some time as a strategy. And nowadays, it's kind of ubiquitously implemented, and you can generally tell your compiler how you want to do it. And there's a compiler choice here, which is why GCC, for example, has these three different options for it. And they differ in whether they use the stack canary on every single function or only functions where it seems like they're at risk because, for example, they have a buffer on the stack. That's a choice that GCC needs to make. And you might say, well, why don't we just do it all the time? Why don't we do it for everything? Well, if you do it for all functions, you know, it can get kind of slow. That if you just do it for a trivial function, there's a lot of them, they're called all the time, and the original stack guard paper measured like 5 to 20% overhead if you weren't targeting where you put these stack canaries to functions that actually were more risky, where risky means like they have an array in them. There's also an issue of space overhead, which is that, well, we added these 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 instructions to our program for each function that's protected this way. Maybe we could save a few of those, but, you know, it's not free as far as how big our executable is. And I should say these numbers are sort of based on some set of typical-ish applications that, like, the stack guard people decided to measure, but this is application dependent. If you have lots of function calls to these risky functions, it's going to be higher. So a question, is this something that might be disabled by C optimization settings? And the answer generally is no, that compilers will let you disable this, but they keep that separate from the optimization settings because they recognize that it's, they mostly recognize that you probably don't have the idea that increasing your optimization level makes your code less safe, that should be a different choice. I say mostly because maybe some of the things the optimizer does don't obey that principle. For example, optimizers will sometimes do funny things to integer overflows, which might not obey that principle. But compilers, when they're thinking about it, try to separate optimizations that are going to hurt your security from other optimizations. Okay. Questions about this overhead? So stack canaries, as you've seen, they're pretty much everywhere, and they're actually a very nice mitigation. They don't require any changes to things like the calling convention, which means that you can apply it, you know, you can do this incrementally. So, like, you can have a library use stack canaries and have the programs that are calling it not have been upgraded to do that yet, and things will work. You only need to recompile that you, as the writer of the C code that is being protected by stack canaries, you don't need to change your code to like use different input functions or add buffer bounds. It just works. There's some disadvantages, like you can't protect your existing executables. You need a recompile to do this. And there's other disadvantages, which is that there's ways of working around it, and we'll get to those topics next. So let's look at these two things we were hoping to be true for stack canaries to work. So one of them is this assumption that our overwrites are contiguous, that to overwrite the return address, we're going to have to overwrite everything between it and the buffer. And this isn't always true. So here, for example, is a sort of notional idea of how this might happen. So I have a function where I ask you what of these array of 8 scores do you want me to edit? So I input a number, I make sure it's in range, and in writing this, I forgot what size of does. And I thought size of, that's how many elements are in the array, but it's not. It's the number of bytes in the array. So this maximum is actually 32. So this is actually going to check whether I is between 0 and 32, which means I can write to the things that would be where scores 8 or scores 9 or scores 10 or scores 11 or scores 12 or so are in is with this code down here. And notably, I can write to the return address part of this without touching the stack canary. Questions about how this works? Okay. So since I don't see any, and let's do just this quick question. What do I pass in to make this happen? So this is, I'm asking, like, what score number and what value do we enter? Give another 20 seconds. Okay, so most of you figured out that we want to ignore 8 and 9, which means that something else was the correct answer. And basically what we wanted to do is we wanted to do the idea of we have to write this value in two parts, but we need to do it not to 8 and 9, but to 10 and 11. So we want our bottom part, these bottom 4 bytes, should go to number 10, and this next part should go as 4 bytes to number 11. So questions on how I figured that out? Okay. So now we see how to do that overwrite. The other assumption we make is that the canary is secret. And this assumption comes from, well, there's nothing in the program that prints it out. But there often are vulnerabilities in programs that result in information disclosure. And usually these seem like not a big deal. So for example, here, I have a function here where I have this variable value, and I can enter a get command and it will print out the value, and it can do that before I've ever set it. And if I just run a get command before running the set command, it's going to print out whatever is in the memory or register the compiler chose to keep value in. And when I compiled this, value was stored on the stack. So this meant I was printing out 4 bytes that was on the stack previously used for something else. If I got lucky, that could have been a stack canary or part of a stack canary. So this sort of thing could end up giving me that secret information. And relatedly, we talked about finding the location of the stack. And it seemed like, gosh, if the location of the stack is random, how are we ever going to figure it out? This same strategy could work for that. If there happened to be a pointer to something on the stack that was previously stored there, and I print it out, well, now I know what that value, what that address is. So questions on, well, we'll go through our sort of concrete example. So for example, if my program, if I call leak and then vulnerable, this, you know, when I tried this, I ran the get command and I got this output, which was because previously this value from this array was stored in the location that happened to be used for the function vulnerable on the stack. And in this case, well, it doesn't seem like such a big deal, but, you know, if we had things work arranged slightly differently, we might end up with part of a stack canary or the stack address, this information that we don't have to, but we need to do our attack. Okay. Questions about So the question is, why would it print the last value of secret? So what happens here is that I call leak, then vulnerable. So what is going to happen here is that leak is, we have our main function here on the stack, and leak runs, and it uses leak, puts stuff on the stack here. Then leak finishes, and vulnerable runs using the same part of memory, and it decides this is where the value variable is, and it happens to have chosen the same location that was used for part of the secrets array. So when we have bugs like this, we often don't have great like flexibility about exactly what gets revealed. But maybe we can like manipulate scenarios to like, you know, get lots of different things on the stack by you know, trying to get the program to do lots of work before it calls this vulnerable function. And either way, you know, this gives us the potential of ending up printing out sort of the sensitive information. Another example, you know, sort of a common type of overflow that might occur is that, oh, you know, let's say I have a null terminated string and I successfully avoid going over the end of this buffer, but when I do that, you know, I don't keep the null terminator, so, you know, if I fill the buffer exactly, I get a little peek at what was below it on the stack, which, you know, could be some, you know, could be a stack canary if we aren't careful. It could be a pointer that will tell us the address of the stack or something like that. Okay. And another example is sometimes I have buffer overflows where it's not obvious how I can turn them into code execution, but I can use them to get some information out. So in this case, I have a struct where I have a buffer that I can overflow followed by a pointer. And the code doesn't use that pointer to like to return to, so it seems like, oh, I can't execute code with this, but it prints out what's at the thing that pointer points to, so this is a very configurable overflow. So if I, for example, input the address where the stack canary is, well, it's just going to print out the stack canary for me. And this obviously is sort of what the attacker would prefer these information disclosure bugs look like. Where you just get this nice, you know, choose what you want to output. It's basically like the program giving you a debugger. So, let's say I have, the issue of, I have address space layout randomization. The starting address for the stack is secret. So these information disclosure bugs, they're a problem for stack canaries. They're also a problem for that strategy of randomizing the stack address. So let's say I have an information disclosure bug here where I have a pointer to P and I can print out the point it points to, but sometimes P isn't initialized. And you can say, well, that's going to crash. Well, it only crashes if like this is null or something. What interesting value could it have left over from whatever was using, you know, that register or that memory beforehand that would be most useful to an attacker trying to find the stack pointer? Oh, did I forget to add a good option here? Wow, okay. So I probably should have added a... I chose these options poorly. So... this is what I get for not reading my quiz code. So, the key thing to realize here, and a subtle point that came up here, is that often when you have these sorts of bugs, you don't get the actual value of your pointer, you get the thing it points to. So here, that was very useful, because we could point at an address and get what that address points to, but here, that's also what's happening. So we actually only learn what this points to. So if we have something that contains a return address, this is actually only going to give us the return address. So this is going to tell us the return address, but that doesn't really tell us, that's not the stack location. And if I have something which lasts contain an input buffer, this will tell us part of the input. But not the value. So the only like option which part of the input, but you know, it's not going to tell us where that is because we're just going to print out three integers worth of data in that was in that input. So what we have to hope for is that, our hope is that P points to another pointer. And this is the only case that might do that, but even then, this was not a good question of me. So so here this is, if it contains a pointer to the stack. So there's a question, won't I not see enough information here to reconstruct a pointer? So two answers to that. So let's say I only got 4 bytes of stuff. If I'm thinking about the stack, an 8-byte stack pointer, that's still helpful because it limits the possibilities. And I could have few enough possibilities left over to guess, or maybe I could combine it with another information disclosure bug to get the rest of the pointer. The other thing is that this example, if these are each 4 bytes, I would imagine the struct point is laid out where we have X, then Y, then Z in memory. So this is actually printing out 12 bytes of stuff. So what we want here is we want P to point to another pointer to get the address of the stack pointer. So it's not going to help if it points to our prior input. We already know what that is. It's not going to help if it points to return address to get the stack address. That's going to tell us where the machine code for the function is, but that's not what I'm asking for here. We want a pointer to the stack somewhere. So questions about my answer to this? Okay. So none of these options really panned out, but we could imagine, P points to a, saved pointer to a buffer on the stack. That would be the sort of thing that would work out, and that will sometimes happen, or maybe we could manipulate circumstances. If we try to get the program, give the right commands to the program, it would do something which would cause that to line up for us. For stack canaries, if you look carefully at this code, the compiler actually went through extra effort to make it so it's unlikely that the stack canary value would show up in an information disclosure bug. Through either one of these uninitialized values would be the biggest concern. And this would be also where we'd probably be most concerned about getting a stack pointer out of here. Because if this was previously used to pull the pointer, in its old function, that would be give us the stack value. And something the compiler's generated code does is that after it compares the stack canary, it clears the register that holds it. And when it compares the second time, stores the stack canary, it clears the register to hold it. When it compares the second time, it uses XOR, which ends up clearing the register as a side effect. And this is trying to make sure that if, for example, we have this scenario and values assigned to the register that held the stack canary value, that we don't have the problem of that value being printed out by accident by the program. So a question, isn't REX in a register and not on the stack? So that is true. And there's two things we'd be concerned about. So one is that it happened to be the case when I compiled this that value was on the stack, but the compiler could basically as easily chosen to use REX or RBX or some other register that may have been used for stack canary stuff for the same purpose. The other issue is that, we might have done something in our function here where we end up writing code that does like push RAX to save the old value of RAX or something like that. And then it would end up on the stack again. Does that answer why we're still concerned even though it's in X? Okay. Questions about stack canaries and information disclosure. Okay. So we looked at stack smashing, which was this very generic attack that worked all the time. And there's one other type of generic attack, which, like stack smashing, because of mitigations, is kind of mostly historical, but we're going to go over because it used to be pretty ubiquitous. And it also illustrates, you know, some interesting things. And this is format string exploits. And the bug here is that this is vulnerable code. The command you entered, command, was not recognized. And the problem is, what if command, like, is %s? Well, what is this function going to do? Well, then we have a call that is printf %s. You know, say, well, that's not going to work because, you know, this %s means look for a string. And there's not going to be a string there. So you might say, okay, so this looks like an information disclosure bug. Right? It looks like we're going to get from this a string printed out that comes from where the arguments are, which is probably some register that, you know, was previously used for something interesting. So it looks bad. It looks like an information disclosure bug we don't want. It turns out it's worse than that. But let's talk about the information disclosure part first to get an idea about sort of what information this gives. So here I have sort of simple program that just calls printf, you know, with that single argument, and I pass in, I want to print out 16 bytes as a long unsigned int in hexadecimal. And this is going to get the next arguments to printf. So this first value would be our next argument here. The second value is going to be our next argument here. So at that first value printed out is the second argument to printf itself, which is whatever was in RSI. So it's just printing out the value of RSI, and then RDX, RCX, R8, and R9. So here I've disclosed the values of all these registers, whatever it was set to. And, well, after we get past there, third through sixth, I can count, past the arguments that are passed in registers, we learned that the calling convention works by passing things on the stack. So here is the 8 bytes on the stack. Oh, this is, the bytes on the stack past the return address are going to be here. So we're just printing out what's on the stack past the return address. And one way we can actually figure this out is that here is the ASCII for percent XL and so on. It printed out what looks like backwards because of how little endian works, but we actually have like the string being that's on the stack being reached because what printf's thinking is, oh, you asked me for that many arguments, that argument must be on the stack where the buffer happens to be. So questions about sort of how we're viewing the stack here. Okay. So far, this just seems like a really flexible information disclosure bug. It's giving us all the information we would want from printf. So the question going back to here, isn't this why isn't this RDI? So this is RSI because RDI here is the buffer, and printf knows that the buffer is the thing that contains the conversions, so it looks after that for the first conversion. So that's why we start with RSI and not RDI. So we have this view that after we go through all the register values, we get values on the stack, and it seems just like really good information disclosure bug, but it's worse than that. And you can find this out by carefully reading the printf fan page, which some people did in the 90s, and realized, oh, that's interesting. And if you pass percent into printf, this is a format conversion, which is very unlike the ones you're used to. You're used to like percent s for a string, and percent d for an integer, percent x for an integer is hexadecimal, percent c for a character. Percent n's really different from that. If you specify it, the number of characters written so far is stored into the integer pointed to by the corresponding argument. So this means that if you do n x, this is going to write, this is going to be the same as setting x to 3, because that's the number of characters written so far. So printf lets us write values, and it writes them through a pointer that it gets from one of its arguments. And we also learned, and what's something that's going to be important, that some of its arguments come from the stack where our buffer might be, or something else that we control. So it ends up being the case that we can use this to write values to locations that we specify. So I'm going to go through an example here where we're going to show how we can use this to, you know, do basically the stack smashing attack, but we're going to, you know, ourselves. And to keep things simple, I'm going to say, here's our shell code is just going to be already in the program, but we can use the same sort of thing we do with stack smashing. We'll talk about how to make that work later. So here I have this vulnerable code, and I want to make it reach exploited. So how am I going to do that? Well, I'm going to use this to write a value to a particular place. And when doing this, I'm going to think about how does my buffer interact with where printf thinks its arguments are. So printf, it only has one argument, but it thinks that argument 7 is going to be at the same place the buffer is, because if it had 7 arguments, that's where its argument would have been pushed, and so on. So what we're going to do, our strategy, is that we're going to use this first part of the space in the buffer. This is where our format string is going to be. That contains that with the percent n commands. And then we're going to have a pointer, the address we want to overwrite. And I'm going to show what that looks like here. So in this case, I'm choosing to overwrite with the address of the vulnerable function I have here. So I've said exploited, I've determined it's at this address. So I'm going to write this format string here where I'm going to make sure that this stuff here, this is going to output exactly 0x40110, the target number of bytes. And why am I doing that? So it's the case that when printf gets to this, you know, is the number stored. Because remember, the purpose of percent %N, why it's supposed to be useful, is it tells you how much has been printed so far. So we've just constructed this to do that. And my main trick for how do I output exactly that much is I can say, oh, please output this number with padded with this many zeros. And I've just chosen the number of zeros. So when I add, you know, this value to the number of extra characters I have before, I end up with exactly the target number. And I've just arbitrarily chosen to do this with the first argument, but I could have done it with some other one. And then I have just something to consume the next few arguments. So I remembered that this first argument here, this is going to use RSI, then RDX, then RCX, and I need to make printf use all of those. And I also need to make printf use all of these values here and skip far enough down onto the stack to find where I put the target address. And I chose to put it in the argument 11 slot because I knew I would have enough space before it to put all the format string specifiers if I did that. And then I used this percent %N specifier to say, okay, now that you know how much has been stored, so now that you've written all this stuff, now store how much you've written into this pointer I've given you here. And also I specify it's a long int, not an int, just so it overwrites the whole thing. So it reads the whole, overwrites the whole 8-byte return address and not something smaller. So a question is, why is this printf argument 7? So printf, so this is this stack here. And in registers, we have printf argument 1, RSI is argument 2, and so on. And I haven't shown those here. So here I'm just showing the contents of the stack. So a question is, what happens to the values in these registers? Are they ignored? They are not ignored. So printf is going to print out the value of RSI, for example, because of this first conversion here with percent %U. So it's going to print it out as an unsigned number. We don't actually care what that value is, but we just want printf to print stuff out. So when we use percent %N, it will store a number that is not zero, because it stores the number of bytes it printed out so far. So the question is, printf will print out a bunch of zeros? So most likely not, actually. Most likely, RSI and RCX and RDX have a bunch of values from whatever was left over when they were last used. Because if we think of the code that's calling printf, it's probably moving something into RDI and then calling printf, and it's not changing RSI or RCX, so they just have whatever values are left over. And we don't really care about that right now, because, you know, we just need printf to print something out, so we don't actually care what's in there. Other questions about what's going on here? So something else notable we had to do is we had to make this target address line up, we had to add some padding in what would be our input before we put that address in there to make it work. Kind of like when we're overwriting a return address, we have to align it exactly where the return address is. We have to align this target address that we want to overwrite, which in this case happens to be the address of a return address, such that you know, it's exactly where printf is going to look for that argument. Now, something that you might complain about here is that I chose this example pretty carefully. So I'm overwriting a return address at this address, which I could put in my input with this address of the function I want to run. And unlike when we were like doing stack smashing, this is a very small address, relatively speaking. Like, it's still a big number, but it's not a big number like this. And if we had to overwrite it with an address that was, say, in the buffer, like, you know, which looked like, you know, D0, you know, so it looks something like this, that would seems like a problem because this is a huge number and we can't have printf output that many bytes. It would take forever. But fortunately, it's flexible and we can use this %n thing multiple times. So, and that's sort of what makes this super powerful exploit, is that we can, instead of writing the whole value in one big altogether, we can say write it in two pieces. So kind of like what we did to use that non-contiguous overflow, we can use the same idea where here I have a format string which uses %hn twice. Oh, and I forgot a percent there. Twice. And the idea is before I write out the 40, I write out the 40 part first because it's the smaller number and I can only increase what %n writes. And then I write out a bunch of extra characters to advance to the second number and write out the second part. So in this way, I can, you know, not, you know, output a huge number of characters and still have the side effect of that outputting be overwriting two things I want. And I just like give the addresses of the different two different parts of the value I want to overwrite. So there's a question of what are these periods for? So printf is, so if this here is address, say, 7,000, then this is going to be 0x6FF8, and so on. And printf is going to look at a particular address, which is a multiple of 8 down from its return address, for this argument 12. So we need to have something when we're putting our input. Our input's going to be all this stuff, including these two addresses. And we need to make sure that address starts at exactly the place where printf is going to look for it. Okay, so questions on how this sort of printf exploit code works. So, format string exploits used to be a pretty big problem. They came up in a surprising number of network services that had some sort of code that looked kind of like this somewhere, or I guess I should say like my original example somewhere, where, you know, people thought, oh, printf's how I print out a string. I have a string. Let's use it. And didn't realize that, you know, that string could somehow be controlled by an attacker. Now, like stack smashing, some things have happened that have mostly made format string exploits not an issue. at least hopefully for new programs. So the way that Linux has solved this problem, as an example which I think is typical, is that by default, a setting called, on typical modern Linux distribution, a setting called fortify source is set to 2. And one of the side effects of this is that the behavior of %n is now changed. They decided this is kind of a really obscure feature that not many people care about, so we're going to selectively break it. And one option they would have, which I don't think actually that many people would complain about, would be just saying, we're getting rid of it. We're not going to have %n be supported because it's bad enough that this is an information disclosure bug when it happens. It's really bad if it that it just always leads to code execution. But they did a little more selective than that. And so what they did is that they made printf not allow %n if the format string was in writable memory. So meaning if the format string was like in a buffer on the stack, it would say no. But if it was a constant in the executable that couldn't be modified usually, it would say okay. It would make it work correctly, work as documented, I should say. Okay, so we've seen this format string exploit, and this is an example of a pattern which comes up a bunch, which is that we have some sort of, basically a sort of buffer overrun that let us overwrite anything. And in my example, I said we're going to overwrite a return address, just like with stack smashing, and make it point to the code we want to run. And I kind of had this step I skipped over of that to do this, we would somehow exactly locate this return address on the stack. It seems kind of annoying. Are there better options? And in fact, there are. There's lots of nice options, or maybe really bad options an attacker has if they have an arbitrary memory write. So we're going to look at sort of what do you do to churn a bug like that format string exploit where you can write a particular memory location of your choice with the value of your choice into code execution. And we're going to look at a bunch of options because we've learned that, well, return addresses are going to be a little hard. Like the stack address varies and there's these stack canaries. So why don't we look for easier targets? And there are easier targets. So let's go through a whole bunch of options. So one idea you might have, which is very reasonable, is that you might think, let's do what we did in the tricky assignment and just overwrite the machine code like for a jump. And you know, that used to work. These days, that memory is probably read-only. So that probably doesn't work. We can try overwriting return addresses. We saw that idea. We can do that directly. If we skip stack canaries, we don't care about the stack canary anymore. But often easier is that, well, there's actually a lot of function pointers. There's pointers to functions all over the place, you know, not just things like return addresses that we'll jump to, but other stored values that point to machine code the program's going to execute. So why would these exist? So one classic example is that if you have code where you want to configure which of several routines it runs, a common strategy is to declare a function pointer. So this is compare is a pointer to a function returning int and taking two char star arguments, which I'm writing down because I don't expect anyone to consider this syntax for declaring a variable intuitive. So here, compare is a function pointer. And basically, I've said, rather than, you know, checking this short case sensitive flag all the time, I store which comparator I use as a function pointer, and I dereference the function pointer to call the function. And if this function pointer, let's say, is we have this function pointer compare on the stack and we have like a buffer before it that could be overflowed due to a bug, well, then we don't need any return addresses. We just overwrite that that function pointer, and we're set. Because, well, whatever code's at that, what that points to, is going to be run when this statement here executes. Okay. So questions about this, sort of how function pointers work? So, question, why are we bothering with this? So, in this case, this seems like just kind of a, you know, we're kind of saving a step of looking up what function it is, but maybe doesn't seem so useful. But function pointers occur in real code all the time. In fact, we've seen them used to, like, kind of skip a lookup before. And this was with dynamic linking. So remember how we had this lookup in the global offset table? That's a table of function pointers. It works the same way. That there's an entry at this address that, in this case, points to the printf function. And that's a function pointer. And if we're thinking of things to overwrite, well, we can overwrite this table entry of the global offset table to point to whatever code. And whenever someone tries to call printf, they're going to run that. So this is an example of that function pointer pattern. It doesn't appear directly in code, in like C code, but the assembly for dynamic linking uses it all over the place. And if we're trying to overwrite a pointer to make it run our code, this pointer that's being read by this jump instruction is a great candidate. So a question, could I also change the pointer to the global offset table? So here the answer is no, because this is based on the offset from the current instruction. So it's hard-coded in this machine code that the global offset table is this many bytes from this instruction. But that idea might come up with other tables of functions that we'll see in a bit. In particular, so function pointers, you know, in addition to being something used internally by the dynamic linker, these actually occur all the time if you look at large C programs. So one prominent example is the Linux kernel. So in the Linux kernel, this is the data structure used to represent a file. And it has this pointer here to a struct called file operations. And what's this struct it points to? It's a struct of function pointers. So if you had a arbitrary value overwrite in the Linux kernel, well, maybe we could find where one of the copies of this struct is stored and replace the read or the write or the seek function pointer in it to point to the code you actually want to run. And this pattern here of having sort of a struct and having a table of the functions to run with it should probably remind you of inheritance. So if you think about inheritance, you like have a class with some fields, and if the inherited version overrides a method, you know, which method gets run depends on which version of the class you have. And this idea is commonly used to implement inheritance, including in most C++ implementations. So if we think of, say, C++ inheritance, so here I have, say, an input stream, seekable input stream, and file input stream, and I have some virtual methods. The most common implementation of this in C++, in assembly from the C++ compiler, involves using function pointers to implement the lookup, where if we have an input stream, how do we know which version of get or seek to call? It's going to be by looking up a function pointer. And the most common implementation is that we'll start the actual object, its piece of memory, with what's called a vtable for virtual table pointer. And for each subclass, we'll have a copy of this virtual table, which is basically just going to be an array of function pointers with a slot for each function that we you know, might override. So, for example, our input stream has a virtual get method and nothing else, so we have a slot for get. Seekable input stream has the get method it inherits and seek and tell, so it has slots for all of them, and we've carefully arranged so that the beginning of the V table for seekable input stream is the same as the V table for input stream, so they're interchangeable. And when we actually have an implementation like file input stream, the V table pointer will point to the actual implementations of these methods. So at runtime, when we take a input stream pointer and run get on it, it's going to go to the VTable pointer, look up the get function pointer, and call it function using that pointer. So something like, you know, this is sort of what the code, the assembly actually ends up doing, is that we, you know, we have our input stream pointer, we get the VTable, we get the get item function pointer from it, and call it with this VTable, which again, VTable, this stands for virtual table. So, which is basically the table of the virtual functions that this class implements. And this is something that we set up when we're like recreating objects. So, you know, so the implementation of our file input stream starts with a pointer to a V table, this table of virtual functions. And when we create a file input stream object, that pointer is set typically to a constant value that the compiler will have set up in advance. Like something like this. We'll just have a pre-declared version of that. So because of this sort of thing of how we implement things like inheritance, either manually like in that Linux kernel code I showed, or, you know, done by the compiler like in this C++ example, we have a bunch of these tables of function pointers. And this is a big target if we have a memory overwrite or even normal buffer overflows. And we have sort of two options for attacking this. So one option is that we can overwrite the table entry directly. Others, we can we can create a new table and in our buffer and make a pointer to that. And that's where I'm going to leave off today because I didn't realize I went over time. Please tell me in the future if I do that. So I'll take questions before I sign off, but sorry about going over. I don't mean to do that. I just don't seem to have a reminder for the time.